You know, I want them to see that there are positive actions that we can take and that we can make a difference. And that's such an important part of giving them hope, because we can, right? This is maybe the last chance, but we still have that chance.
Rabbit it on. Rabbit it on. Rabbit it on. Rabbit it on.
Rabbit it on.
Hello, it is wonderful to be here with our 11th episode of Rabbiting On. I'm not quite sure how we've managed to get this far. I'm Rabbi Miriam Berger, and I'm joined, as always, by my wonderful friends and colleagues, Rabbi Robin Ashworthstein and Rabbi Debbie Young-Summers. Lovely to see you both.
Hello.
Hi.
I was wanting to know how you are, and I feel we sometimes, like, we have these conversations and we talk about, you know, what's made us exhausted or what's made us laugh this week or whatever else. I was wondering if there was anything that made you angry this week. What have you been getting riled about or animated about in some way?
It's such a good question, because I think my default position is generally jolly. I suppose on a kind of meta level, I was a bit infuriated by kind of reading reports about what was going on at COP26 and all the stuff around accessibility. And it's just so embarrassing that we've organized this worldwide conference and not thought about the queues of people. Apparently they oversold tickets. There were five hour long queues for people to get into the buildings. There was an Israeli diplomat the Minister for Energy, mm-hmm. I think it was, who couldn't access the room she was speaking in because they wouldn't allow her electric wheelchair into the building. That's really infuriating. And plus climate change.
Climate change. Yeah, I like how you started that. It was so British, Debbie. It's quite infuriated. Accessing our anger is an interesting thing. I got angry this week. I get angry a lot, actually. I was in a waiting room, I won't say where, and the radio was on, and it was talking about COP26 and all stuff to do with that. And everyone around me was like, oh, not this again. I can't be bothered with this. Why do they always have to talk about it? We've got other things to think about. And I was like, really? I was so confused by it. Like, we're going to talk, aren't we, about, you know, climate change and how we deal with it and how it can be overwhelming and anxiety provoking and all that kind of stuff. But it was so dismissive of it. And I was angry about it. Yeah, that was my moment. I'm still angry, actually. Can you tell?
I kind of feel like people have become dismissive about so much stuff that's been massive for the last couple of years. Like, yeah. I feel like I'm the only person wearing a mask anywhere.
Yeah.
I was getting trolled on Twitter last week for like saying I liked a particular mask. People saying, oh, well, masks don't do anything, but they help us spot the idiots. I'm just like, okay. They had 40 followers. It's not a big problem. But, you know, I feel like people have been so worried for such an extended period. And now we're just like, done.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, crazy. I have to say, though, what ties up all your stories are kind of the embarrassment of other people and their views of kind of not being able to look past themselves. I was furious this last week that we'd been with a group of local organizations trying to support the Merkaz, a local Muslim community who were having all sorts of problems with the planning permission, taking over a new building for their Muslim community center. And finally, you know, their planning permission was rejected and they've walked away from the site. And funnily enough, a large mega church has walked in, no problem at all, no issues with planning. And, you know, apparently they don't cause as much problem with parking and noise. I mean, it's just racism. We just have to call it and name it because it's just embarrassing. And it makes me so furious about the world around us and how on earth we create a just and fair society when these are the people that we're trying to live alongside.
Yeah.
And perhaps that's really what takes us from your examples of COP26 into a bigger conversation around it. I feel like at this point we should have Carrie Newcomer joining us to be singing, If Not Now, Tell Me When, because it's really that urgent need to act, to talk, and to be able to take action and know where we're going. We're told that the last decade was the hottest on record, as you say, Robin, we can't get away from the fact that people are talking about COP26, but actually slightly worrying that people are not sitting up and going, there's a reason all our world leaders have come together on this one. Mm. This is really significantly important. I think there's something quite extraordinary about 197 countries being present at the same thing and realizing this is everybody's responsibility to reduce their carbon emissions and try and get to that net zero. It's just quite frightening to be talking about quite how long that might take. I think it takes us into that image with Noah and the covenant between God and humanity and that sense of, you know, as faith leaders, I think we're often thought about the people who just, well, you know, things are out of our hands. But this is a real partnership moment. This is our way of being able to step up, be the stewards of the world that Genesis sets us up for, and to be able to ask that question of what is our part? What part do we as individuals need to play and our world leaders need to play?
It's really fascinating, that word steward, because I think there are two places in Genesis where it sort of gives us this idea that either we tend and till the land in Genesis 2 or in Genesis 1, it says we should dominate and subdue the land and the world around. And, you know, it's not necessarily the way we'd want to go, but it is kind of how we have established ourselves, right? We spend our time fighting to keep nature out of our homes and spaces and to control it, to do what we want it to do. But I think that term steward is used by lots of faiths as an understanding of what we would like to have a relationship with the earth in. There's an amazing eco-thinker called James Lovelock who wrote Gaia, and he says that he would actually really like the faiths of the world to let go of this idea of stewards of the earth. Although it's wonderful that we get involved in green campaigning and awareness, stewarding the earth isn't actually what's needed, because the earth is completely fine without us. We're the problem in many senses, right? And the example I was given this, like, has anyone seen I, Legend with Will Smith?
No.
So New York's been taken over by zombies. And Will Smith is basically the survivor. And he's roaming around the streets trying to find supplies with his dog. And without humanity there, New York City's basically been taken over again by nature, right? You have trees growing up in the highway and herds of deer running through the city because we battle to keep that stuff out all the time. Whereas, you know, when we are gone, nature just returns. It's actually, I would say, about learning to live in balance in a way that benefits us and the world around us, because without that balance, we're just going to lose it all by trying to steward or dominate or whatever it is we do. But there's a beautiful midrash that always kind of comes to me when we think about those Genesis instructions, where God is walking with Adam in the Garden of Eden and showing Adam all the different trees. And it's from about 1500 years ago. And God says to Adam, you know, I made all of this for you. Please don't destroy it or damage it, because there's no one to come after you to clear it up. I'm not going to come and fix this. In other words, if we don't do it, so if we create the problem, God's not going to swoop in and fix it all, which I think is a very easy theology to lean into, right? The idea that it'll all be fine because God will fix it. You know, God's promised not to destroy the earth again with Noah's Ark, but this isn't God destroying the earth. This is us, and it's our responsibility. And Midrash understood 1500 years ago that it was our responsibility, and God's not going to come and pick up the pieces.
But is this different from anything else that actually we spend our lives battling against nature, right? Is this different from cancer and trying to understand why people die too early of cancer and be able to kind of save their lives from it? Or are there kind of those natural moments? You know, for me, it's not so much about battling against the world, but what does it mean when there are people who are living in parts of the world where there is drought and famine? Like, we have that biblically as well. We have an understanding of what it meant for, you know, Jacob's children to be suffering from famine whilst Egypt was managing to feed its population. So there's a piece around maybe we're always set up. Any campaign, anything we look at is about us kind of battling against that which is natural.
Although if we look at that model, what the famine in Egypt teaches us is that we have to work together. as humanity to do this, right? When you try to survive in tiny little tribal groups, that becomes challenging when there's a global or national crisis. Whereas in Egypt, they work together and it supported. And that's how the Shemitah system works, right? The sabbatical system every 7 years doesn't work to stop farming unless you are all going to support each other and share everything. It's just a totally different way of looking at our economic systems. But you know, we already know that people living in the South Pacific are struggling to hold on to their land because the sea is literally seeping up through the ground because they're such low-lying islands. You know, this is happening already.
Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, when we think about, you know, climate change and other things that we're doing and all of the, I'll use the word kind of loosely, causes that are out there that we could find and, you know, give our energy and time to. And often when you hear people who are doing kind of direct action around the climate crisis, so Insulate Britain, and maybe we'll talk about, you know, tactics, how, you know, how to create change efficiently and things. And I know that's quite controversial, but they always say, but this is so huge, everything has to stop to take account of this. And when I hear them say that, I think, oh my God, this is everything. Like, it kind of pales into insignificance, because if we don't do this stuff, there will be no earth for us to keep campaigning and making sure it is a fair and just world. And certainly for me, in my little kind of empathic, sensitive body and soul, gets completely overwhelmed by this stuff. I think I was saying to you before that if I was a child in this moment where climate, the crisis is really, you know, taught at school, it's everywhere, and it's very much the young generation, it's put on their shoulders, isn't it, in a way, to inspire and lead. And Greta Thunberg has said, how dare you look to us, you know, because we just keep looking to the next generation to make the changes. I'd be completely overwhelmed. I'd be terrified of being in this world knowing, you know, what could happen within a decade or so. And having seen the videos, I have to stop myself sometimes watching the videos of places where flooding is already, you know, in Kuwait, you know, the temperatures are so high that someone there was saying, on the BBC was saying, it may not be habitable in a couple of years. I can't take my kids out to the playground during the day. It's just too hot. And this has only happened in the last few years. I have to stop watching that kind of stuff because it's just terrifying. And it's completely fundamental as well.
And do you think we view it differently, having had the experience of COVID? Then actually, I think there's something about understanding the influence we have on countries far away differently. Like the amazing kind of the extent of the catastrophe of somebody arriving by plane into another country and suddenly creating a spiral of infection in that other country. There is something about our leaders, our adults and our children seeing that sense of the impact that our behavior here can have on their lives there. I think is different than it's ever been before. It isn't just about that tribal, we need, you know, to feed our people in this part of the world, but that understanding of the spiraling effects of, it doesn't matter where you are in the world, you're contributing to the issues in Madagascar, Kuwait, the polar ice caps.
Yeah, I think you're so right with that. And I think like within the Jewish tradition and certain sets of Jewish teaching, because we can be quite particular in our Jewish teachings, but the universal element that we have in our Jewish teachings, intellectually, we always know that we're connected to everybody. We're all made in the image of God. We've got that beautiful text that we share with the Quran about, you know, if you kill somebody, it's as if you destroy the whole of humankind. So we definitely have in our toolkit and understanding that we are all connected. But I think you're completely right that until COVID, it hit us in a way that we knew it in our bodies and souls, not just kind of intellectually, and how responsible we are. I think COVID also shaped things because, you know, things that climate change activists have been working on for years, all of a sudden overnight happened. Mm-hmm. You know, air traffic stopping, people not driving into work, all of this stuff. And obviously it was because of a devastating time, and it's not that I would wish that at all. But it's fascinating that we could see actually global change was even possible. We have the possibility of working together, so understanding that we're all connected and then doing something about it. There was a model for that. It came out of crisis. And are we in enough crisis now? Have we hit the rock bottom we need to? And will it be too late? That's the kind of big meta question I'm kind of left with.
I wonder if it also relies on that, like, selfishness of people. That actually, you know, when your own prime minister is in hospital with COVID, all of a sudden it's okay to kind of lock down and close businesses and stop air pollution or, you know, air flights. But is this too much for people as a, oh, well, we don't know exactly what it will lead to. We can't see the tangible effects yet. Are people not willing to make the drastic changes that need to happen because it's not directly affecting their lives to the same extent?
But I also think that it can feel really overwhelming because it's such a big task. And me doing my little bit doesn't change very much. But when all of us are doing our little bit, it can have a massive impact really quickly. And it's that challenge of getting people working together. I mean, for me, that's one of the beautiful things about being part of a Jewish community is it's a group to act with. It's not just me. It's, you know, as a community, we can make a difference if we all do the same things. I remember an amazing Look North report that I saw a few years ago when the 10 5p charge came in for plastic bags. There was a report from, I think it was the Fishermen of Hull or somewhere in that area, that within 2 weeks of the 5p charge coming in, the fishermen could visually see the decrease of plastic in their seas.
Wow.
Around Hull. And I just think, on the one hand, we didn't do that ourselves. It had to come down from above, right? We had to be told we were going to be charged. I'd been using reusable bags since the early 2000s, because when I lived in Sweden, they were already in 2002 charging people for plastic bags and paper bags. In fact, if you didn't bring your own bags, you had to buy one. And I just got into the habit of it then. And it's this challenge of acting as individuals collectively to make a change, but also needing government and needing our supermarkets and needing our global companies to take responsibility to stepping up and making those changes happen. Because it's hard to motivate oneself to do the right thing alone. We need to act collectively.
And mostly it's just habit. And it's just needing the push to change the habit, which we have seen, you know, with that example exactly, that we can change habits really very quickly when we need to.
Mm-hmm. And sometimes it's slower. You know, I think I saw a statistic last week that meat consumption over the last 20 years has declined by something like 35%, which is a really significant shift. And it's interesting, there's this sort of meat-free Mondays campaign that you see around on social media sometimes to try and get people to reduce one day a week that they wouldn't eat meat. In our house, we save meat for Shabbat. So it's kind of the inverse. We only eat meat on Shabbat or Chag. And that sense that in doing that, our Jewish values make a statement about how important the environment is, how special it should be to eat meat, that it shouldn't be a regular thing. And actually, I really value that I pay 3 times more for my chickens than the normal supermarket does, because I don't think a chicken should cost £2.50 or £3, right? It should be something that is valued higher than that as a commodity. But on the other hand, I come from a place of privilege to be able to say that, right? Not everyone would be able to afford to do that. And I think so much of the challenge of environmental choices sometimes feels rooted in a position of privilege, that we can choose the more expensive thing that's not wrapped in plastic, that we can choose the wooden toy rather than the plastic toy. I mean, I think there are lots of great, cheap environmental choices we can make, like buying all our clothes and children's stuff secondhand, right? There is enough baby guff in the world now to keep us going for at least 20 years. You know, babies wear tops for 2 months and they're done. And there is a great recycling system between mums and dads that goes on. But it's that awareness that every time we buy something, there's an impact. We might put something in the bin, but the bin goes somewhere. It doesn't just vanish into a magic portal. It's all still on Earth.
Yeah. And I think that's one of the issues, isn't it, in being in this kind of modern society, is that we're, as you say, we can be so disconnected from nature and the effects of it, because we put the bin out and then it gets taken somewhere that I don't see and have to think about. And it's interesting because in our biblical roots, of course, was all tied to the land. And every single festival we have, Shabbat, the Shemitah concept of the 7 years, was all because we were so intimately connected with the land that we celebrated, we marked things in every single way. And I think partly it's a call back to that. And certainly I in synagogue have been much more aware and bringing those connections to the land and agriculture into the festivals in a way that I don't think I used to, really realizing that. And I loved, you know, this conversation about our power as individuals, because it can feel very helpless and you think, you know, I'm just doing my little bit recycling. But we have such power, like collective beings, as a community, Jewish synagogues, like the eco-synagogue, the idea of our community is really committing to being eco. But also, we can create change by our habits and changing them. I think of like being vegan. So I'm vegan, and you know that because I keep telling everyone, as we do. But, you know, veganary, I always don't know how to say it.
Veganuary.
Anyway, that has made Burger King now do vegan burgers. You know, being kosher, as we may be, and lots of us will be, never had a veggie burger. And now the big conglomerates are opening that space and everyone's doing vegan stuff. So it just shows you that it's all about demand and what we want, and they will, you know, cater to it. So it is the small acts that we can do and holding each other to account. And certainly my son now will say to me, oh, we shouldn't buy that because it's got plastic on it. Do we really need that? Shouldn't we recycle it? Do you think we could reuse this? And it's all about all of us holding each other to account, because it does matter. And this idea of like, oh, well, it's just me, is kind of, it gives some of our power away, really. And that's, you know, and absolutely, the government have to be the ones leading. They are the ones who have the greatest power in the sense of being able to create change on a vast scale. But I don't want to give our power away as individuals as well, especially within communities.
I think the government's greatest power is to create the incentivization. That actually what we know is that we change habits quicker when we are incentivized, and that we can hold on to the big picture stuff to a certain extent. But actually, I know it's really hard to maintain that and to kind of keep the momentum. So for me, I hold my hand up. I was driving my son to school, the literally 5 minutes drive to school every morning until the petrol crisis. And actually, we didn't, you know, I wasn't prepared to sit in queue for petrol for hours on end. And so we parked the car and I was like, I need to have a tank of petrol, enough in our tank to get me to and from the cemetery in case I need to do a funeral. Other than that, we don't really need to use the car. So let's preserve it. Let's keep it. Changed my habit, started walking from school. It was so nice, right? I get a 20-minute walk all the way there and all the way back from school with my son, where we actually talk. And I get 40 minutes in the reverse journeys, you know, after I've dropped him off and before I pick him up, where actually I'm doing a bit of exercise and just having a bit of space outside in the open air. You know, sometimes it just takes that little incentivization, you know, through crisis or through being able to understand that this is actually the impact. I could have been told 1,000 times of the climate impact on those 5-minute drives being awful for the environment, but it needed it to directly impact me.
And actually, one of the powers that we have as individuals is to help incentivize people up the chain. So I've tried in various ways at different times to live for the first 6 weeks, and then it was a year without doing any shopping except for sort of food and essentials. And then I also spent a year with a vicar friend of mine trying to live plastic free. And now you can't live completely plastic free, or at least I couldn't. I'm sure someone can, but you know, there's always things that come up. So what we ended up doing was packaging up everything that came off of our supermarket shop in a nice recycled plastic bag and posting it back to the supermarket's free post customer service address. Now, if everybody was doing that, there was also a little campaign a while ago where people were unpackaging everything at the tills and leaving all the plastic at the tills. If everyone was doing that, the supermarket really quickly would get done and be like, okay, this is holding things up. This is creating problems. And we have seen that supermarkets are doing a little bit to reduce plastic. And there are some fantastic, I can't remember what they call them, but these packaging-free refill shops now. We've got 2 or 3 near us. And it is more expensive. Again, it's a privilege to use them. But the more people do those things, the more it brings the price down. And we also have so much packaging in our home that we can reuse, like glass jars, right? If we were instead of buying decorative fancy spice jars and things and just reusing what our stuff has already come in, instead of putting that in the recycling, reusing is always going to be better than recycling, because recycling takes energy, and plastic is very hard to recycle. Glasses and metal is easier. But
I did notice even at the fish counter yesterday, it had a little thing like, you can bring your Tupperware. Like, we don't need to give this to you in a bag. You can bring that with your bags for life and know that you're taking less packaging home with you.
That's brilliant.
I think what's really interesting is what you said about motivation, Miriam, because there are so, as Debbie said, like, there is an infinite number of ways we can change our lives relatively easily to do this stuff. And yet, you know, I do a lot, but I know there's more I could be doing, having an electric car, those kind of things. So really thinking about, like, how do we incentivize ourselves and motivate ourselves if it's not right in front of us, if there's not, like, if it's not tangible to us, and if there's not a payoff for it as well. And I think sharing stories is really important, like hearing stories. This is why I do force myself to watch, you know, around the world, hearing what the climate, you know, activists have to say, but really being open to hearing all of that, to have that in my mind when I'm doing it, but also to think of ways that we can motivate other people and incentivize in that way as well is an interesting question.
And the opposite of the incentivization is an interesting public debate. I was fascinated by the media outlets that were interviewing, you know, the drivers who were stuck behind climate change protesters and Insulate Britain as they, you know, couldn't drive to work. And obviously, you know, picking the doctor who needed to get to surgery and, you know, that kind of thing. I get it, right? That's the story. That's the debate. That's the rub. But actually, it creates the discourse like you had in the waiting room of, oh, gosh, they're talking about climate change again, rather than, wow, these people are really focusing on the thing that I'm managing to push away and pretend is not happening. And they're forcing me to face up to it.
And the chaos that climate change alone will cause is going to be so much worse. So much worse.
Apparently one of our, I was on a panel for the Baked In, the religious court, and one of our Baked In candidates was stuck with in the traffic, and then they had to pull over and zoom into the interview. So they did it from the service station because they couldn't get there. And I was caught in that moment of, oh gosh, how terrible, because that's their journey, you know, that moment really building for years towards it. And at the same time, the action made me stop and think, oh my gosh, we've got to do something now, because if not now, when? And it's this really, and I think, you know, living with that tension in us is a huge amount of, we're individually not doing enough, collectively not doing enough. And how do you hold all of that and still live your life and find joy and meaning in it? Because it can be completely overwhelming. We've got our weekend away coming up with the Northern Communities for Reform Judaism this weekend, which I'm really excited about. And the theme is going to be on the climate, partly because of COP26 and also just because it's urgent. And it's hard because it's the first time we're all going to be together and we're celebrating. So we're going to hold all of that alongside the world is burning. You know, we are destroying the earth beneath us. And really, that I find it hard to find the balance between being able to be in the world as I am and find the beauty of it and not be so completely overwhelmed that I just can't get out the door of, like, what's the point?
And
like,
actually, oh, the challenge of that is for our kids as well, who a lot of this is for, right? We want there to be a world for them. And I want them to be conscious, as they already are, but we don't want them to be overwhelmed by that sense of, my gosh, is this irredeemable now? You know, I want them to see that there are positive actions that we can take and that we can make a difference. And that's such an important part of giving them hope, because we can, right? This is maybe the last chance, but we still have that chance. And human innovation can be part of the solution. It's not only bad news that we are creative and that we build and that we develop technologies, but we need to find ways of doing it that are better.
Yeah,
I think it's that Jewish imperative as well, that actually we're one of the few religions that isn't evangelical, isn't trying to say everyone needs to be Jewish, but rather let us as a Jewish community be that light unto the nations. Let us show you, let us show the way that we could be doing this better. And perhaps taking that role model approach within community life and being able to say, how do we as a collective change things locally and between our own ourselves and as a community, so that we can do that opportunity to be able to share that with others and hope that they step in.
Yeah, it's kind of amazing. I know this is like a very simple thing that I'm going to say, but it's so profound, really, that we have this idea of Tikkun Olam and this idea of tzedakah. That, like, you know, because I was thinking, Deborah, when you're speaking about children, you know, growing up with it. And Gabriel certainly had a moment. We went to a zoo, and I'm really not a big fan of zoos. Maybe that's another podcast thing. But anyway, we were there. We saw the penguins, his absolute favourite. And then they had a big board about climate crisis and how it's affecting penguins' habitat. He was, I mean, distraught. He was hysterically crying. He was so upset that his penguins were, you know, their homes were being destroyed. And of course, what we did was we then sponsored a penguin. We got the thing sent to us. We did the tzedakah. We did the Tikkun Olam, because it's, and it's obviously not just particular to Jews. It's just that that's our language for it. But it is so fundamentally part of what it is to live our life as Jewishly, and particularly with progressive Judaism. It's something to be very proud of, isn't it? That a pillar of how we express our Judaism is this. You know,
just reminded me, there was an article a couple of years ago that I can't remember who it was by, but I think it basically was a critique of progressive Judaism, saying it's all about Tikkun Olam. And everyone was very upset and angry about this article. And I was like, if that's the greatest insult you can find about Reform Judaism, I'm going to take that. I'm good with being great. All we'll about Tikkun Olam. That's right. And actually, we know we're about a lot more than that. But actually, that's not an insult, right? We have to see the positives of when someone thinks they're calling us a name. That's not a name. That's a compliment. Thank you very much.
Yeah, and it's such a compliment, like, that we understand Tikkun Olam as meaning we've got a sacred duty. It's how we express finding holiness and divinity in the world. And also, going back to a bit earlier in our conversation, it shows us fundamentally, and I'm sure that our kids know this, that they have power. They have actual power to create change in the world through those concepts. And actually, I hadn't really thought about it in this context, but that's very hopeful. That makes me excited about, I worry about the anxiety for kids and for myself, but actually knowing also that we have integrated into our beings already this idea that together we can create change and have is really powerful. And we just need to keep reminding ourselves about that hope, but also take action.
I certainly hope that our northern communities are part of leading the way after their special Eco Shabbat, this Shabbat as Northern Haggigah, and that all of us around the country who are going to be creating something special this Shabbat in terms of being able to reflect that which is going on in the world with our own Jewish practice as we look into ourselves and our own actions and start to think about how we can assess who we are and what part we are playing in this huge global issue. We know that we're told it's not our job to finish the work, but we certainly can't step away from doing our part, because we all need to step up and take that challenge.
Absolutely. And on a personal note, we said there's so much information out there, isn't there? It's so hard to know exactly where to start on what to do. But something that is free, quick and easy is you can measure your own personal carbon footprint. Yeah, this is one small thing in the whole host of things that we can do and others can do as well. And you can go to the WWF's website. Apparently that's Pandas Not Wrestling. And it's footprint.wwf.org.uk. And also in the show notes, there'll be loads of links and resources as well. So you can go into Eco Shabbat, hopefully energized and inspired with some tools in your toolkit.
And lots of our communities are part of Eco Synagogue, but the movement itself is now joining up. Eco Synagogue have been up at COP26 doing their bit and representing. Rabbi Mark Goldsmith was up there manning the stall for the day, along with other colleagues from across the denominations. And it's just so important to keep talking about it and keep conscious.
So feel free to drop us a line and let us know what your community is doing to tackle climate change. Then we can all enjoy the role model that your communities are setting and follow suit. So make sure that you email us at media@rjuk.org or on Twitter at Reform Movement and Reform Judaism UK on Instagram. We're looking forward to hearing from you. We are back next week because we just can't get enough of all of this. And we're going to talk about weddings and mixed faith blessings and how we, within the Reform movement, mark that moment of transition and the bringing together of people at that moment in their lives. So I hope that you will tune in next week and be part of that conversation as well. Hopefully a little more celebratory and congratulatory than this week's somewhat despondent frustration of what climate change is doing to the world. Lovely to be speaking with you, Robin and Debbie, and look forward to seeing you all soon.
Lovely. Look forward to seeing you at the Simcha. Should only be Simchas that we have to talk about. So looking forward to that conversation. Bye.
Bye, everyone.
Bye.